Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I am a strong supporter of the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, and civil liberties. But you have no civil liberties if you are dead.
Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Republican Pat Roberts of Kansas says the confirmation hearings for General Michael Hayden got underway about a half hour ago. General Hayden, of course, nominated to run the CIA. Issues are expected to include Hayden's expertise in technical, not human, intelligence, a military man running a civilian intelligence agency, whether Hayden can resist pressure to politicize intelligence on Iran and other hotspots, whether the CIA can do a better job of smoking out the bad guys than they did before 9/11, or a better job than they did assessing Iraq's weapons programs, and Hayden's role in the possibly illegal, warrantless wiretapping program. We'll see if some senators try to get around Senator Roberts' admonitions to keep secret this secret program. Here's more of what Senator Roberts said.
I want to applaud the brave men and women of the intelligence community who are implementing this program. Their single focus and one and only motivation is preventing the next attack. They are not interested in the private affairs of their fellow Americans. They are interested in one thing: finding and stopping terrorists. America can be proud of them. They deserve our support and our thanks, not our suspicion.
Not our suspicion, says Senator Roberts. Michael Hayden is 61 years old. He has a 37-year career in government, much of that in military intelligence. He is the highest-ranking uniformed intelligence officer, and he is appearing before the committee in uniform this morning. He ran the NSA, the National Security Agency, from 1999 to 2005. And you now have a choice. Listen to the hearing gavel to gavel and uninterrupted on AM 820 WNYC, or stay here on 93.9, and we will bring you live excerpts, most of this morning's proceedings, and jump in from time to time with analysis. We will set it up a little bit right now with Kevin Whitelaw, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. Kevin, thanks so much for coming on with us today. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
So you heard Senator Roberts there. Are you surprised that he came out swinging about the NSA surveillance program that way?
He's basically all along been pretty supportive of this program and of the president when it comes to this. And so, no, I think he's trying to set a tone for this hearing in the same way that I think the administration was trying to set a tone for the hearing by holding this somewhat unusual closed door briefing yesterday for members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees on the controversial eavesdropping program. The idea is to try to figure out how to turn the focus of the hearing away from that, which is obviously expected to be the most controversial part of it, towards more of General Hayden's qualifications, which the Bush administration is really quite proud of.
So yesterday, the full Intelligence Committee of the Senate and the House were briefed on the surveillance program, something the White House had resisted doing before, and that makes all the questioners today, since this is a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing, privy to classified information. How much does that actually limit questioning today?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, the Senate Intelligence Committee obviously does most of its work behind closed doors, most of it in the classified realm. So they always have to wrestle with how do they ask questions in the open realm. I think what you'll find is they will ask questions and probably for the most part accept it when General Hayden says, I can address that behind closed doors. I can't address that in an open forum. I think you're going to hear that response to a lot of those questions. There is some suspicion, clearly, that the administration was trying to make it that much more difficult to ask questions by briefing it. But at the same time, it probably could help them avoid ill-informed questions, perhaps, which might just confuse people as to what the programs are really about.
And I heard Senator Levin in his opening statement, he got to do the Democratic opening statement since the actual ranking Democrat, Jay Rockefeller, is out with a back ailment today. But he seemed to say, hey, look, a lot of this has been reported publicly now, and so a lot of this, in effect, is not classified. So yeah, you bet we're going to ask questions about these things, right?
Well, that's clear. They're going to ask questions, and at the same time, I think they will end up respecting what General Hayden says about what he can or cannot talk about in an open session. General Hayden for an intelligence officer, for someone who spent a lot of time running one of the most secret organizations in the intelligence world, the NSA, actually is very comfortable in public forum and very comfortable in talking about his highly classified work in ways that are public but not revealing sensitive secrets. And so I think you'll find that he will talk about things in general terms. He's been out there as the public defender of this surveillance program for a couple months for the administration. In some ways, that actually might be one of the more sticky sort of topics for General Hayden, is that you saw in a letter that Senator Rockefeller wrote to General Hayden, since he can't be at the session, it was one of the things he brought up, is this question of General Hayden's role in becoming the public defender, which meant not only explaining the program but also promoting the program, if you like, and whether that crossed the line between politicization of intelligence or not. And so I think you'll find that will be another area that they can talk about without any classification problems that he'll have to overcome.
In fact, with all the suspicions about politicization of intelligence before the Iraq War, this is another thing that Senator Levin brought up in his opening remarks, and here's a brief excerpt of that.
One major question for me is whether General Hayden will restore analytical independence and objectivity at the CIA and speak truth to power, or whether he will shape intelligence to support administration policy and mislead Congress and the American people as Director Tenet did.
So, Kevin Whitelaw from U.S. News, how much do you expect that to be a focus of the conversation today?
I do think there will be some Democrats who will want to make that the focus. I think they'll have a little trouble really sort of landing any blows on General Hayden with that, because he's not really tied up with too closely with that, you know, with the Iraq analysis critique. He was, you know, able to escape that largely. And in fact, if you look through the 9/11 Commission report, the actual text doesn't even mention General Hayden. So
But I get the feeling, Kevin, and tell me if you disagree, that it's not going to be so much about trying to vilify anything Hayden has done in the past on that score as trying to elicit some promises from him on the public record that he's going to be independent and that he's going to tell the president and the vice president about intelligence the way they actually find it, rather than about intelligence the way they might want to hear it.
Absolutely. And in fact, he's obviously anticipated that and in his opening remarks said something very close to that, about speaking truth to power, saying that he will, as he expects every analyst will, always give our nation's leaders the best analytic judgment. And he does talk about that question directly. But you're absolutely right. They're going to want to get him on the record there. They're going to want to have something they can hold up later. The slight difference here, of course, now is that when you were confirming a CIA director, for every previous CIA director, the confirmation was also for the director of Central Intelligence. So you were confirming two people at the same, you know, sort of two jobs for the same person, including running the entire intelligence community and being the president's chief intelligence advisor. That job is now held, of course, by Director of National Intelligence John Negroponte.
Because they put that new position in up above the CIA director.
Right, that's correct. And so in this case, the CIA director, if it is General Hayden, if he is confirmed, will not be the president's chief intelligence advisor. He'll actually be reporting to the president's chief intelligence advisor. And so it obviously the independence of the intelligence judgments are still going to be incredibly important, because the DNI's office relies largely on CIA for the analytical work. But at the same time, it's an interesting question whether the independence means independence from Ambassador Negroponte or not.
So all right.
There's several interesting layers of that question that will be interesting to see how they get there.
Before we go to the hearings, one other thing. I mean, we've been talking so far about politicization of intelligence, which is a political issue as well as an intelligence issue, and we've been talking about civil liberties questions surrounding the warrantless wiretapping program. What about the fundamental question of how well the CIA does its work, whether the CIA can do a better job of smoking out the bad guys than they did before 9/11, or a better job than they did assessing Iraq's WMD programs?
Well, that's right, and there, you know, there have been some improvements under Goss, but there's also been a lot of problems and a huge morale issue and a huge loss of personnel. So he'll be whoever does step into that job, assuming it is General Hayden, he will have a difficult time dealing with an agency that has become very, very young. It's really amazing. Almost 50% of the analysts have less than 3 years' experience, which is remarkable. And this means it's, you know, they have a real lack of experienced mentors and managers, both on the clandestine side and on the analytical side. And so that's going to be, you know, a huge problem as you try to figure out how to go after these difficult targets and be creative and smart about it. Now, at the same time, General Hayden has a good record as director of NSA. He was the agency's longest-serving director and really helped turn around an organization that was very much in danger of complete obsolescence. And setting it on the right direction, not fixing everything, but at least sort of really turning that big ship around. So he does come in with sort of that executive ability and management ability and leadership skills that I think people feel have really been lacking over at the CIA. He also has said that he wants to bring in, as his deputy, one of the CIA's most respected clandestine officers in recent years, named Stephen Kappas.
Was he sort of purged by the previous CIA director, Porter Goss?
It wasn't exactly a purge. It was more being caught up in a personnel dispute with some of the aides that Porter Goss had brought in from Capitol Hill. And so he was sort of a bizarre casualty of a personal clash, and a lot of people were very upset that Director Goss had allowed that to develop that way and allowed sort of them to lose him over something that really should never have happened. So it wasn't a purge, and again, you know, talking to, as I do, you know, both current and former intelligence officers. Almost every single one you can find calls Stephen Kappas one of the best clandestine officers they've ever worked with, and so I think his appointment has already done very much to reassure people about the kind of work that General Hayden will do. In fact, I think that with anything, I think that what the CIA will be looking for is a concern that with Hayden coming from the DNI's office might be more interested in trying to centralize everything and even push bits off to the DNI rather than build up the CIA. And
right.
So I think you see in his remarks a pretty solid attempt to say, hey, look, I realize how important the CIA is. We need to build up these capabilities, not the other way around.
This is 93.9 and AM 820 WNYC. We are listening. We are talking with Kevin Whitelaw, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. And just to brief people on where things stand now on the Hayden confirmation hearings, they have actually taken a short break for some procedural business that the Senate has to do following the opening statements by the ranking Republican on the committee, Pat Roberts, the ranking Democrat in attendance today, Carl Levin, and Hayden himself. We understand it's just going to be another minute or two, and as soon as they resume, we will go to the hearings live. I assume, Kevin, that Senator Roberts, as chairman of the committee, will get to do the first round of questioning?
That's right. Normally they would start with him and go from there. And, you know, I think it'll be pretty obvious, I think, for most of the questioners without looking at, without knowing whether they're Republicans or Democrats, it'll be pretty easy to figure out who's friendly and who's not. So, again, one of the things that General Hayden does have going for him is up until the revelations about the surveillance program, he really was one of the most respected leaders in the intelligence community on Capitol Hill. He really developed a very good relationship with them. So I think you'll see a lot of questions that are friendly, even if some of them turn a little confrontational, with the actual question.
We'll continue with Kevin Whitelaw from U.S. News and then dive into the hearings as soon as they resume. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. A special edition today as we cover the first few hours of the Senate confirmation hearings of General Michael Hayden to run the CIA. They're in a short break now, and as soon as they resume, which is expected to be any minute. We will dive into the first round of questions, probably to be started by the chairman of the committee, Pat Roberts, Republican from Kansas. Kevin Whitelaw, senior writer with U.S. News and World Report, who covers intelligence, is with us for another few minutes. And Kevin, I guess we should mention that despite the issue controversies that we've been talking about and that the Democrats are going to try to hammer away on today, General Hayden himself seems to have a great deal of respect on both sides of the aisle, and in fact was confirmed for his previous position with a unanimous vote of the United States Senate.
Well, that's right, and he came in as actual, in some ways, his nomination as Negroponte's deputy smoothed the way for Negroponte because he brought with him this institutional knowledge of the intelligence community that some people had been concerned that Negroponte lacked. So, you know, it's a bit of an irony that in the same way that Hayden had been the reassurance for Negroponte, Stephen Kappes, the CIA veteran, is now the reassurance for General Hayden.
Right. But
I think one of the things that's been a little overblown in some of the concern, the questions about General Hayden has been this image of him as a tech guy, because he really did run the NSA for 6 years, which is a technical agency, but he had before that a range of experience of different kinds of intelligence work, both as a defense attaché abroad and in other intelligence roles. So he actually had familiarity with a number of different kinds of intelligence. And then in his work at NSA, he actually had to coordinate very closely with the CIA, because these days, with the way eavesdropping works, so much of it is targeting based on human intelligence. So there's this real back and forth between those two agencies. And I spoke with a former CIA officer, John Brennan, whose job it was at the CIA at one point to coordinate these kinds of things with General Hayden. And he found General Hayden to be just amazing, both in his understanding of how human intelligence works, but also in his ability to sort of put the interests of the intelligence community at large first over his own agency. And so I think he comes into this with a lot of support from a large swath of former leaders of and former top officials at the CIA, as well as other parts of the intelligence
community. And Kevin, I know you got to go in a minute, but the head of the House Intelligence Committee, Peter Hoekstra, a Republican, came out right after the nomination was announced and said, this is the wrong man for the wrong job at the wrong time. How come?
Well, you know, it's interesting to look at that. There's a number of different concerns that he's been talking about. A lot of it having to do with General Hayden's time as a status as a military man and others. I think if you really read between the lines, though, Representative Hoekstra and a handful of other critics in the House, they were really quite close to Porter Goss, and I think in some ways it's not as much an attack on General Hayden as it is an attack on the removal of Porter Goss. And so I think what you will also find as a bit of an undertone, even in the Senate hearing, is some amount of debate on the Goss tenure and whether it was as bad as most people have been describing it as.
Of course, Goss came out of the House, so should we assume that the House Intelligence Committee members were closer to him than the Senate Republicans on the Intelligence Committee, and there is not a PETA Hoekstra on the Intelligence Committee to contend with today?
I expect you'll find at least one person sort of talking about that. I'm not exactly sure who it's going to be at this point, but I think you will find a couple questions along those lines. But you're right. If this was a hearing in the House, it would be a very different, much more contentious hearing, in part because of that. But I think that to a certain degree, again, General Hayden, smart political operator, appeared before Congress many times, was careful to praise Porter Goss in his opening statement and praise his tenure at the CIA, albeit in very general terms. So I think that we'll have to see how that plays out. You know, having said that, the Senate committee has largely been pretty critical of the CIA's performance and even Porter Goss's tenure. So I think that the general tone will actually be one more of concern about, you know, what's going on at CIA rather than a sort of that an antagonism from that aspect.
Kevin Whitelaw, senior writer with U.S. News and World Report. Thanks a lot for coming on with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're joined now by Holly Bailey, White House correspondent for Newsweek. Holly, thank you for coming on with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
As we continue to await the end of this short break for some kind of procedural maneuvers that they need to do in the Senate so the Intelligence Committee can get back and begin questioning Michael Hayden, which we keep being told will happen any minute. Do you know the status of what's going on there?
Well, essentially, the Senate, at the same time they're considering this nomination, they're also trying to basically vote out an immigration bill. So we're going to see, I think, senators going back and forth a lot today to deal with that.
Interesting. Is there going to be a vote possibly today on this much-debated immigration bill?
Well, they've been voting in a lot of amendments. Last night, they actually voted on a bill that would make it was sort of a nod to something that conservatives have been wanting, which would be to construct a fence along the Mexican border with the United States. And so, yeah, they're just continuing on to vote on the amendments. I think a vote on the larger bill is supposed to happen perhaps as early as tomorrow.
How did the vote on the fence turn out?
I'm not sure on the exact numbers. I do know it passed, and it passed with a lot of Republican support.
And this is a fence that would only go along, what, a few hundred miles of this few thousand-mile border?
Yeah, essentially. It would be along New Mexico, Arizona, California. Pretty much it would be almost the same thing that the House bill voted on. And that's one of the things that, you know, people had been looking for, you know, wondering if that would be included in the ultimate bill. There still is a question about whether President Bush would sign something like that. And the White House really hasn't given any indication.
So do you expect the Senate to come out with a bill, you say it may be as early as tomorrow, that is substantially more liberal than the House bill, and then they're going to go into some very thorny conference committee negotiations?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that we've really been waiting for. And one thing that's the president really, you know, senators have been really critical of the president over the last couple of weeks, accusing the White House of really not coming out and saying exactly what the president wants. And that was a point of strategy for the White House. They were hoping to hold their fire a little bit until the Senate and the House bill negotiations went forward and trying to hammer out a compromise bill. But ultimately, you know, the president had to come out and say something. That's what happened with the speech this week. And so now everybody's sort of watching. I mean, there is sort of a consensus that the Senate is going to pass a bill that includes some form of the worker program. The House bill does not include a worker program, and House Republicans have indicated that they will not support anything like that. So it's going to be, I think, a nasty fight in the end.
So do you think these negotiations are going to go through, let's say, the 4th of July recess?
It's hard to say. The real struggle is, you know, the Senate's going to pass their bill, but then there's the struggle of who's going to be on this conference committee. You know, certainly I think the White House doesn't want to see somebody like Tom Tancredo, the Colorado congressman who's very far to the right of the White House on immigration. They don't want to see somebody like that on this conference committee. So I think that it'll be the Senate passing the bill, then the question will be who's going to be on this conference committee, and then, you know, certainly there will be a long debate on what exactly should, you know, ultimately come out in a compromise bill or whether they will find a compromise at all.
So there will be detail after detail after detail subject to agonizing debate during the coming weeks.
Absolutely.
And does this happen more or less in public, or does the conference committee take place behind closed doors?
A lot of it is behind closed doors, but, you know, there will be, I mean, some of this coming out publicly, and especially because, you know, this has been a very divisive debate in Washington. I mean, this is one of those few bills where there's not really anybody right in the middle. There's somebody that everybody has a position on it here in Washington. So that makes it a lot more difficult to kind of come to an agreement that everybody can be happy with.
Holly Bailey, White House Newsweek White House correspondent, my guest on WNYC as we await the resumption of the Michael Hayden confirmation hearings to be CIA director. We'll go back live as soon as they come back from this vote on a piece of the immigration bill. Getting back to General Hayden, he was director of the NSA from 1999 to 2005, if I have my facts straight. Does that mean he was appointed by President Clinton?
It would seem so.
So there is some bipartisan history with Michael Hayden.
Yeah, and I don't know if that really helps him. I mean, really what everybody's focusing on today, this isn't so much necessarily a hearing about General Hayden, but really a hearing on the NSA program. And I thought what was interesting today, just in terms of the comments that we heard in the opening statements from Senator Roberts and Senator Levin, just, you know, again, them focusing on first the controversies about, you know, the CIA and what kind of intelligence and the credibility of the intelligence that they've been giving the administration, but also just questions about, you know, obviously they're not going to be able to say what happened in those briefings yesterday, but Senator Levin's statements that, you know, seem to still back up the USA Today story, you know, in which we've had Verizon and Bell South come out and say that we didn't give information to the NSA, you know, he's still backing that story up. So that would seem to indicate that maybe they learned something yesterday that sort of confirms that stuff.
Interesting. You know, we had a Bell South spokesman on the program yesterday, and he was unequivocal. I tried to get at him every which way about, you know, little holes in his denial and whether there were kinds of things that he wasn't quite saying that they may have been cooperating with the NSA on, whether there was a contract with a sub-provider of long-distance service who they contract with or anything like that. And his denial was so blanket that it's hard to imagine that, you know, even a corporate spokesman was being so phony as to cover up something substantial that's really going on with the kinds of words he was using. What do you make of all that?
Well, I think, you know, I think what's something that everybody's watching is the language here and what they're saying. And, you know, certainly everyone's on the lookout for legalese and little loopholes. And I don't think we really ever know. But what's interesting to me is just, you know, if the story was completely wrong, why they didn't deny it last week?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now they are settling back into their places, it seems, in the Senate Intelligence Committee chamber. They have not yet begun the questioning, but this will start again in just a minute. Senator Roberts is there. General Hayden is getting settled. This question of a military man running civilian intelligence because of the traditional civilian control over the military in the United States to prevent things like military coups or the military having an independent base of power in the United States like it does in some other countries. How much do you expect to hear that articulated, and how much by Republicans today?
Well, I think it is something that has come up more in the House. That's correct. But there has been some movement in the last couple of days. Talk about a bill that would basically you know, allow him to keep his military rank if he is ultimately appointed head of the CIA. But what would happen is that he would, the bill would, I guess, waive Secretary Rumsfeld's power over him. And so basically it would just give him an exception while he's serving the CIA.
And another question is Hayden's expertise in, all right, now I think they're about to get into the questioning, and again, the Intelligence Committee Chairman, Republican Pat Roberts of Kansas, gets the first go, and then I presume Senator Levin, who is the ranking Democrat for today, with Jay Rockefeller out with a back ailment, will get the first round of questioning for the Democrats. Are they ready to go? And we are seconds away now. So Holly Bailey, White House correspondent for Newsweek. I guess another dynamic here is going to be, as you just described with Senator Levin, just how much they try to work around what is classified about the surveillance program to comment on it, especially on the Democratic side.
Right. I think what's interesting, what was important about those briefings yesterday is now they know the kind of questions.
All right. Now I'm going to jump in and break in because now Senator Roberts is beginning the questioning of General Hayden. So, Holly, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And we take you live to the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Do you agree to provide documents or any material requested by the committee in order for it to carry out its oversight and its legislative responsibilities?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Will you ensure that the Central Intelligence Agency provides such material to the committee when requested?
Yes, sir.
General, there's an interesting commentary in your opening statement about the endless picking apart of the archaeology of past intelligence failures, and that CIA officers deserve not to have every action analyzed, second-guessed, and criticized in the newspapers. And I agree that it is time to look forward, not in the rearview mirror. And I agree that the press is not the place to air these kind of grievances, whether those grievances originate from outside or inside the agency. But it is important to be clear, not having your actions second-guessed is something that is earned, not deserved. After the Iraq WMD failure, the inquiry that was conducted by this committee and approved with a 17-0 vote that proved without question we had an egregious intelligence failure, this committee simply cannot accept intelligence assessments at face value. We have learned, and when I say we, I'm talking about every member of this committee, when we have hearings and when we have briefings, we ask the analyst or we ask whoever is testifying, what do you know? What don't you know? What is the difference? And then the extra kicker is, what do you think? And we scrub it. Now, I believe it is necessary for the committee to rigorously examine the CIA's judgments about Iran, about North Korea, about China, about terrorism and proliferation as we work together to ensure that there is not another failure like the Iraq WMD failure. General, the Iraq WMD failure wasn't a failure only because the ultimate assessments were wrong. We both know that you can have a good analytical tradecraft and still get it wrong. Nobody bats 1,000 in the intelligence world. But the Iraq WMD failure was due in large part to a terribly flawed tradecraft. General, as CIA director, what steps will you take to improve the agency's analytical tradecraft?
Senator, as I said in my opening statement, that's up there in the top rung. I mean, ultimately, we're everything that CIA or any part of the intel community meets the rest of the world is in its analytic judgments. Collection and science and technology support are behind the screen with that analytic judgment. And so it is the pass-fail grade for CIA, for the DI, for the intelligence community. We've already begun to do some things, and here I think my role would be to make sure that these changes are underway and then to reinforce success. Two or three quickly come to mind. One is something that you've already suggested, and that's almost it's vigorous transparency in what we know, what we assess, and what we know we don't know. And to say that very, very clearly so as not to give a policymaker or a military commander, any decision maker, false confidence. The second, I think, is a higher tolerance for ambiguity between ourselves and between ourselves and our customers. This is going to require the customer to have a little higher tolerance for ambiguity as well. He or she is just going to have to be a little less in a little less comfortable place when an analysis comes out that is truly transparent in terms of our confidence in different layers of confidence, levels of confidence, and different parts of our judgment. There's got to be a little more running room, too, for he said, she said, inside the analysis, that dissenting views aren't, I guess, abstracted out of the piece. You know, we just kind of move it to the next level of abstraction, and underlying disagreements are hidden. And that dissenting views aren't hidden by a footnote or other kind of obfuscations. We really have begun to do that. In my current job, I get to see the briefing that goes forward every day, and there is a difference in its texture and a difference in its tenor. As I said before, Senator, that's the pass-fail grade. Everything else is designed to support that final analytic judgment.
Well, the CIA is clearly working, as you've indicated, to regain the trust of the policymakers and its customers, and I'm not trying to perjure the dedication and the hard work that our men and women of the CIA do, risking their lives in behalf of our country. The men and women in the field, I think, are doing an excellent job, the rank and file. The agency has made improvements, particularly in analysis. But the best way for the CIA to earn trust is to give analysts across the community the information they need to perform sound analysis and to encourage collectors to take any and all necessary risks so they can collect the needed information. And I believe these actions are also the best way to restore the CIA's sense of pride, a goal that both you and I, and obviously the folks down at the CIA, share. General, in your assessment, is the CIA taking the risk necessary to get the analysts the intelligence they need to provide policymakers with sound analysis?
Senator, that's one of the areas, as I suggested in my opening statement, that I really want to take a very close look at. And I don't know how to answer your question. Is it doing enough? That's going to be some level of discovery learning for me. But let me tell you what it is I think I do know about this. We have the same dilemma at NSA. There's always the risk that the more transparent you are, the more you may reveal and thereby compromise sources and methods. The same dynamic at Langley. At NSA, it's a little easier maybe to start pushing against the shoulders of the envelope here and get a little bit more risk embracing, because if NSA oversteps and got a little too bold in sharing, at the end of the day, what they lose is a frequency. CIA gets a little too bold in sharing, at the end of the day, there could be real personal tragedy involved. And so, although the approaches will be similar, I do understand that the protection of human sources might be a bit different than the protection of signal intelligence sources. All that said, Senator, I think the agency itself would admit that it is among the more conservative elements of the community in terms of sharing information. There are good reasons for that, as I just suggested. But just as we did at NSA, when we held our premises up to the light, when we looked at things carefully, we found that we actually had a lot more freedom of action than perhaps our rote procedures would suggest. That's the approach I'd take at the agency. It'll be careful, but we'll be moving forward.
The comment I would make in response to the first question that I ask you is that it appeared to most of us on the committee, certainly to the chairman, that the 2002 National Intelligence Estimate became more or less of an assumption train, in part based on what was known after the first Gulf War. I believe it was David Kaye who indicated after the first Gulf War that Saddam Hussein was 18 months away of having a missile delivery capability that was nuclear, obviously within range of Israel. And everybody thought at that particular time and scratched their head because that estimate was not 18 months, it was much longer than that, and said, well, we're certainly not going to let that happen again. And so the assumption was, of course, we have to err on the side of national security and security of that region. Now, having said that, most of the other intelligence agencies, if not all, around the world, were on the same assumption train. The inspectors came in, and the inspectors were asked or forced to leave. Virtually everybody, members of Congress, people in administration, other intelligence agencies all throughout the world, assumed that Saddam Hussein would reconstitute his weapons of mass destruction. I think he probably thought he had the weapons of mass destruction. Anybody that would go in to see him and tell him he didn't probably wouldn't go out. I think many in the military thought, different generals, this particular unit of the Republican Guard had the WMD and this did not. But as we saw upon closer inspection, as the committee worked through very diligently, interviewing over 250 analysts, we found out exactly what you said, that there were dissenting views, that there were caveats, and added together, it did provide a picture that was most troubling. And that's about the nicest way I can put it. So what I'm asking you again, and you've already answered this, will you put those dissenting views, those caveats, that frank discussion of, wait a minute, let's take a closer look, so that they are at least on the assumption train. I don't know where they would be, in the middle of the train, front of the train. Might want to put them at the front of the train, not the caboose. Don't let the caboose go so we don't get into this kind of a failure which we just simply could not afford. Would you have any comment?
Yes, sir. I couldn't agree with you more, and you're right about the analysis. We just took too much for granted. We didn't challenge our basic assumptions. Now, as you point out, there's historical reasons for that. In a sense, it's understandable. I'm not trying to excuse it, but there is an historical background to it. That should teach us an awful lot about taking assumptions for granted and letting them stand without challenge and without just simply looking and seeing, can I put these pieces together in a different way? I think we're doing that. If we're not doing it enough, we'll certainly do more of it. That's precisely what it is we have to give to the nation's policymakers. Senator, one more thought, though. All of this is shrouded in ambiguity. If these were known facts, you wouldn't be coming to us for them. And so we'll do our best to tell you what we know, why we think it, and where we're doubtful and where we don't know. But I think everyone has to understand the limits of the art here, the limits of the science. Again, if this were all known, we wouldn't be having the discussion.
I'm going to add one more question before I turn to Senator Bond. You made the comment in regards to information sharing. Senator Rockefeller and I have been pushing a concept called information access, i.e., if you're into information sharing, somebody owns it, then they make a decision as to whether they share it or not. Now, I'm not going back to the not-so-thrilling days of yesteryear where we looked at the intelligence community as basically a whole series of stovepipes of information with one agency very difficult to share information with another. And we just can't afford that. And I think we've made great steps, more especially with the National Counterterrorism Threat Center. But you've indicated some concern in regards to sources, methods, lives. Could you amplify a little bit on that? Because we have been pushing information access, full access to the entire intelligence community as we work together jointly now to protect America as opposed to information sharing.
Yes, sir. And that's what I was trying to suggest in my opening statement, that we really have, on the transaction level, they ask, we respond. Within the American intelligence community, we're world class. I mean, we really are good at that. And so when you go out and talk to someone about sharing, they can pull out these statistics about the number of requests and the speed of the response and so on. And in a different world, that would probably be very satisfying news. But no matter how well you do that transactional basis, you're not going to get to the agility we need to fight the current war. It can't be in an ask-respond mode. That simply will not work. So we have to move to a world in which there's common information commonly shared. Now, that's a challenge because there are no fooling tradecraft and sources and methods concerns. But I think the line we've got now is my premise is the line's too conservative, and that'll be my attitude if confirmed and if I go to the agency.
I appreciate that very much. In the second round, I may touch upon that need for agility, i.e., hot pursuit, given the threats that we face today. Senator Bond?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Welcome, General Hayden.
Sir.
There are many questions that should be asked of you about your views on where the CIA goes and your qualifications, but I think there's been enough discussion that perhaps we should clarify a few points based on your previous role with the President's Terrorist Surveillance Program. So let's just get this on the record so everybody will understand.
Sir.
Are you a lawyer?
No, sir.
Congratulations. Did your lawyers at the NSA tell you the program was legal? Do they still maintain it's legal?
Yes, sir, they did, and they still do.
How about the Department of Justice lawyers, the White House legal guidance
yes,
program
sir.
Was legal?
All that was consistent.
Did you ever personally believe the program was illegal?
No, sir.
Did you believe that your primary responsibility as director of NSA was to execute a program that your NSA lawyers, that Justice Department lawyers and White House officials all told you was legal and that you were ordered to carry it out by the President of the United States?
Sir, when I had to make this personal decision in early October 2001, and it was a personal decision, the math was pretty straightforward. I could not do this.
It seems to me that if there are questions that people wish to raise about the legality of the program or its structure, those would most appropriately be addressed to the Attorney General or other representative of the legal staff of the executive branch. The next question I think is very troubling because of so many aspersions, assertions, characterizations, and mischaracterizations. You addressed at the National Press Club the fact that the president has said this is designed to listen in on terrorist programs coming from overseas. This is to intercept Al-Qaeda communications into or out of the United States. Could you explain for us the controls that you have to make sure that somebody doesn't listen in on a domestic political opponent, or listen in on a neighbor, or listen in on a business rival, or listen in on the media? You explained that. For the record, could you tell how this program is controlled to make sure it stays within the boundaries that the president outlined, the Constitution, the statutes require?
Yes, sir. And in fact, the way you framed it is the way I think about it.
The current questioner, by the way, is Senator Christopher Bond, Republican from Missouri.
You suggested others are far more expert than I. The second is that it's done in a way that it's effective. And the third, that it's done just the way it's been authorized. And I think your question deals with that last pillar.
Right.
What we did, we have a very strict oversight regime. The phrase we use for the phenomenon you were describing is called targeting. The targeting decisions are made by the people in the U.S. government most knowledgeable about Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda communications, Al-Qaeda's tactics, techniques, procedures. It's gotten close oversight. It has senior-level review, but it comes out of the expertise of the best folks in the National Security Agency. I don't make those decisions. The director of SIGINT out there doesn't make those decisions. Those decisions are made at the program level and at the level of our counterterrorism officer. They're targeted on Al-Qaeda. There is a probable cause standard. Every targeting is documented. There is a literal target folder that explains the rationale and the answers to the questions on a very lengthy checklist as to why this particular number we believe to be associated with the enemy.
And these are reviewed by who reviews these?
There have been several layers of review. There's obviously a management review,
right?
Just internal to the system. The NSA Inspector General is well read into the program and does routine inspections. I mean, literally pulling folders, examining the logic train, talking to the analyst to see if the decisions were correct or warranted by the evidence in the folder. That's also been conducted by the Department of Justice. They've done the same thing. They've looked at the folders. And to the best of my knowledge, the folks out there are batting 1,000. No one has said that there has been a targeting decision made that wasn't well-founded in a probable cause standard.
Is there a possibility that somebody could sneak in a request for something that isn't an Al-Qaeda communication?
I don't know how that could survive in the culture of the National Security Agency, Senator. It's a very disciplined workforce.
What if an analyst or somebody who is engaged in directly engaged at the lowest level decided to pick up some information on somebody who was out of favor, who didn't like? How would that be caught?
Senator, actually, I mean, I recognize the sensitivity of the program we're talking about here, but actually, that would be a problem in any activity of the National Security Agency.
So this
would
this
engage
is,
in
this
inappropriate
is,
this targeting.
This is not a program, a problem that is specific to the president's program. Anytime you have an NSA,
right. And anytime you have the agency working, of course.
And the question is, what do you do to make sure that everybody stays within the guidelines?
The entire agency, its general counsel, its IG, I mean, that's what it's built to do. to do that kind of oversight.
And what if they get out of line?
Well, number one, no evidence whatsoever they've gotten out of line in this program. In the history of the agency, there have been, you know, I'll say small number of examples like that. Those are detected through the normal processes, IG inspections and so on, and action is taken.
I was at the agency and I saw the extensive oversight. I also heard on early morning radio somebody who'd been employed at NSA for 20 or 25 years call in, and he was asked good questions by the morning show hosts, and I believe his reply was, when they asked him why he couldn't do that, he said because he didn't want to spend 10 to 15 years in prison.
Sure.
Is this the kind of penalty that would ensue if somebody did that?
Sir, I can remember the training I got there and continued throughout my 6 years at the agency. And this training is recurring. It must happen on a recurring basis for everyone there. And during the training, everyone is reminded these are criminal, not civil statutes.
So what would your response be to the general accusations that tens of millions of Americans are at risk from having their privacy exposed in these communications?
Senator, the folks at NSA didn't need me to prod them on, but let me tell you what I told them when we launched the program. It was morning of 6 October in our big conference room, about 80, 90 folks in there, and I was explaining what the president had authorized, and I ended up by saying, and we're going to do exactly what he said, and not one photon or one electron more. And I think that's what we've done.
You've mentioned briefly about the impact of leaks on this program and other classified programs. What has happened, in your view, to our intelligence capability as a result of the leaks and disclosure of our activities?
Senator, it's difficult to quantify. I mean, there are so many variables that affect our ability to move against the enemy. But I can't give you a statistic, but I can't help but think that revelations like this have an effect on the enemy. Now, this program will continue to be successful, all right? But there'll be an effect here. I mean, this, you can actually see this, and I'm speaking globally about disclosures of our tactics, techniques,
right,
procedures, sources, and methods. It's almost Darwinian. The more we put out there, the more we're going to kill and capture dumb terrorists.
Because the smart ones will know,
yes, sir,
how to avoid it. I think Porter Goss in this room in February said the damage to our intelligence capability has been very severe.
Yes, sir.
And is that a fact?
Yes. Oh, yes, sir. I mean, if you're talking beyond NSA, beyond signals intelligence,
right,
the whole panoply, there is easily documented evidence as to...
Going back to the NSA, I gather that there are some folks who really would like to see this program shut down. They may be phrasing it in various terms, but I suspect that there are some who say it ought to be shut down. What would happen to our ability to identify and disrupt a planned al-Qaeda attack in the United States were that to happen?
Sir, my personal view and the reason I accepted this in October 2001 is my responsibility to help defend the nation. The folks who run this program, I think, believe and correctly believe they make a substantial contribution to the safety of the republic. I went out to see them at the height of the first furball about this, and you know, they're doing their jobs, but it was a difficult time. But the only emotion they expressed to me was they wanted to be able to continue to do their work. Their fear was not for themselves or they had done anything wrong, but that they wanted to be able to continue to do what it is they had been doing. And now that's a better judgment than mine. All right, these are the folks who feel it, who have that tactile sense for what they do and what they affect.
Let me move on to the things that really should be the focus of this HUMINT is obviously the chief responsibility of CIA. You have been a SIGINT man for most of your career.
You're listening to live coverage of the Senate Intelligence Committee's confirmation hearings for General Michael Hayden to head the Central Intelligence Agency from NPR News.
Gathering capacities.
Sir, just one clarification for the record. I've actually been a HUMINTer. I was an attaché behind the Iron Curtain for a couple of years during the Cold War, and that's kind of in the center of the lane for human intelligence.
All right.
Actually have more human experience going to CIA than I had SIGINT experience before I arrived at NSA. Now, with regard to looking forward, two games going on simultaneously, and both equally important. One is inside the agency, you know, dealing with CIA HUMINT, helping it become all that the nation needs it to be. And as I suggested earlier, more non-traditional cover, more non-traditional platforms, more risk-taking. And Senator, I need to be honest, this would be reinforcing efforts already underway. The other game is over here in the broader community. And I think it's singularly significant that Ambassador Negroponte made the director of CIA the national HUMINT manager. There are other folks out there on the field playing this game, DOD, the FBI, other agencies, and both of them are bulking up in terms of their capabilities. This is a real opportunity to do this really well on a scale we've not been able to do before. And so I think there's got to be an equal amount of effort in that community role as well.
Yesterday at the Defense Appropriations hearing, Secretary Rumsfeld assured us that there's total, complete working interoperability and cooperation between the Department of Defense and the CIA and other agencies in human intelligence. Has that been achieved, or is that a work in process, a goal towards which we are working? And what do you think, really, about the relationships between the FBI, NSA, Department of Defense in the clandestine service?
Yes, sir. I think it's best described as a process that needs to be continually managed. You've got folks out there quite legitimately, but for slightly different purposes. They should be using common tradecraft. They should be using common standards. They should be using the same standards to validate a source. They should be using the same language and the same formats when they make reports. Those are the things that the National HUMINT Manager should ensure. Right? I know there's been a great deal of comment and concern about recent DOD activity and how it might bump into traditional CIA activity. I can tell you, in preparation for this, I've asked that question for the folks who are trying to get me ready for the hearing. Frankly, I got a better news story than I had anticipated.
We're most interested. This committee is most interested in that. So please tell
us. Yes, sir.
They talked
about the MOU that had been signed between DOD and the CIA in terms of how to coordinate and deconflict human activity. It's actually working. When there have been frictions, it's come about more out of inexperience than malice, and that we need to continue to move along those lines. Now, I know this is an important question for the committee,
We'll pursue that later on this afternoon,
yes,
but can you, unclassified discussion, what's the military desire to expand human intelligence and get into areas of covert action? To the extent you can discuss it here, what is the proper responsibility between the Department of Defense, Human Intelligence Operations, and Central Intelligence Agency, Human Intelligence Operations?
Yes, sir.
Is there a bright line?
Actually, I think that's what it is we're trying to do, is to create a bright line, and I think maybe the reality is that what DOD is doing under Title 10 authorities and what CIA does under Title 50, actually where that line should be drawn, they get kind of merged so that the actions are actually on the ground, in reality, indistinguishable, even though their sources of tasking and sources of authority come from different places. Right? That's where we need to manage this. That's where this needs to be done well. Let me explain this in more in terms of opportunity than of danger, even though, you know, clearly we've got to do this right. I think it's a fair case can be made that in several theaters of war right now, Iraq, Afghanistan, that the CIA has picked up a large burden and done it very well, a burden that is many times in direct support of U.S. military forces. To have DOD step up to those kinds of responsibilities doesn't seem to me to be a bad thing. And if that frees up CIA activities to go back towards the more traditional CIA realm of strategic intelligence, there's a happy marriage to be made here, Senator.
I recently read a book on the CIA's role, a novel, or a book on the CIA's role in Afghanistan. And according to the former CIA man who wrote it, the CIA was the one that did it and did all the important things, and the Department of Defense did not step up at the appropriate time. If you had an opportunity to review the general operations of the CIA in Afghanistan and the interaction with the Department of Defense there?
No, sir. I've not looked at it in detail.
All right,
I'm sorry.
We'll talk about that later. Probably final question. There was some objection within the agency to the DNI sending 24 CT analysts to the National Counterterrorism Center as part of the lanes and the road. Do you think that the objections from within the agency were justified, and to what extent should the NCTC be engaged in the all-source terrorism analysis? To what extent should the CIA do the same?
Sure, it's a complicated question, but truth in lending, obviously I agree with it because that's what I was trying to do in my current job as Ambassador Negroponte's deputy. This is actually what I was trying to refer to in my opening remarks when I talked about conforming the shape of the CIA to meet the new intelligence structure which you have all legislated while still sustaining high ops tempo current CIA operations. I mean, that's that dilemma right there. Briefly, and perhaps in a later round or this afternoon, Senator, we can get into more detail. Here's what I see the challenge is. Right now, and in a really good, in a really powerful sense, a lot of the engines of American intelligence are attached to today's very successful operational activities. And that the fact that Director Goss and the President and others can say that some significant percentage, and it's a big number, of that organization that attacked us in 2001 has been killed or captured is a product of all of that focus. But this is a long war, and it's not just going to be won with heat, blast, and fragmentation. It is fundamentally a war of ideas, and we have to skew our intelligence to support the other elements of national power as well. That's the tough decision. How best to allocate our resources and then apportion it organizationally so you keep up this high ops tempo that has Al-Qaeda on its back foot right now, while still underpinning all the other efforts of the U.S. government that over the long term cuts the production rate of those who want to kill us and those who hate us, rather than simply dealing with those who already have that view.
Thank you very much, General.
Senator Levin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General, in answer to one of the pre-hearing questions of the committee, you indicated that your role in developing the NSA's program that we've discussed here was to explain what was technically possible in a surveillance program.
Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan.
My question is this. After you explained, presumably, to the administration what was technically possible, did you design the specific program, or was the specific program designed elsewhere and delivered to you?
Senator, it's going to take a minute to explain, but I think you'd want a complete answer on this. Let me give you the narrative as to what was happening at that time. As I briefed the committee in closed session, I took certain actions right after the attack within my authority as director, and I informed Director Tenet, I formed this committee, and I informed the House committee as well. And after a discussion with the administration, Director Tenet came back to me and said, is there anything more you can do? And I said, not within my current authorities. And he invited me to come down and talk to the administration about what more could be done. And the three ovals of the Venn diagram, as I described it, were what was technologically possible, what was operationally relevant, and what would be lawful. And what, you know, where we would work would be in that space where all three of those ovals intersected. As I said to Senator Bond, my role was, here's technologically possible, and if we could pull that off, here's what I think the operational relevance would be. And there was then followed a discussion as to why or how we could make that possible. I was issued an order on the 4th of October that laid out the underpinnings for what I described.
So you participated in the design of the specific program?
Yes, I think that's fair, Senator. Yeah, I think that's right.
Now, if press reports are true, that phone calls of tens of millions of Americans who are not suspected of anything, but nonetheless those records are maintained in a government database, would you not agree that if that press report is accurate, that there is at least a privacy concern there, whether or not one concludes that security interests outweigh the privacy concerns?
Oh, Senator, I mean, from the very beginning, we knew that this was a serious issue, and that the steps we were taking, although convinced of their lawfulness, we were taking them in a regime that was different from the regime that existed on 10 September. I actually told the workforce, not for the special program, but the NSA workforce on the 13th of September, I gave an address to an empty room, but we beamed it throughout our entire enterprise, about free peoples always having to decide to balance their security and their liberties, and that we, for our tradition, have always planted our banner way down here on the end of the spectrum towards security. And then I told the workforce, and this has actually been quoted elsewhere, I told the workforce, there are going to be a lot of pressures to push that banner down towards security. And our job at NSA was to keep America free by making Americans feel safe again. So this balance between security and liberty was foremost in our minds.
Does that mean your answer to my question is yes?
And Senator, I understand there are privacy concerns involved in all of this. There's privacy concerns involved in the routine activities of NSA.
But would you say there are privacy concerns involved in this program?
I could certainly understand why someone would be concerned about this.
But that's not my question, General. It's a direct question.
Sure.
In your judgment, are there privacy?
You want me to say yes or no?
No, I want you to say whatever you believe.
Yes, sir, and here's what I believe. Clearly, the privacy of American citizens is a concern constantly, and it's a concern in this program. It's a concern in everything we've done.
All right. That's a little different from the press club statement, where basically you said the only privacy concern is involved in international phone calls.
No, sir, I don't think it's different. I was very clear in what I said there. I was very careful with my language. I mean,
is that the only privacy concern in this program, the international phone calls?
Senator, I don't know how to answer your question. I've just answered that there are privacy concerns with everything that we do. Of course, we always balance privacy and security, and we do it within the law.
Is the only privacy concern, though, in this program relate to international phone calls?
Senator, what I was talking about in January at the press club was what the program that the president had confirmed. It was the program
that he had confirmed publicly?
Yes, sir, that he confirmed
publicly.
Is that
the whole program? Is that the whole program?
Senator, I'm not at liberty to talk about that in open session.
I'm not asking what the program is. I'm just simply saying is what the president described publicly, the whole program.
Senator, all I'm at liberty to say in this session is what I was talking about, and I literally explicitly said this at the press club. I am talking about the program the president discussed in mid-December.
And you're not able to tell us whether what the president described is the whole program?
No, sir. I'm not in open session. I am delighted to go into great detail in closed session.
Thank you. The NSA program that The New York Times on March 14th reported about, said that NSA lawyers, while you were the director of the agency, opposed the vice president's efforts to authorize the NSA to, quote, intercept purely domestic telephone calls. Is that story accurate?
I could recognize a thin vein of my experience inside the story, but I would not characterize how you describe the Times story as being accurate. Let me give you a few more notes on that, Senator.
But were there differences between the NSA and the Vice President's office about what the desirable scope of this program was?
No, sir. There were discussions about what we could do. Our intent all along in my discussions was to do what it is the program does as described, one end of these calls always being foreign. And as we went forward, we attempted to make it very clear that that's all we were doing and that's all we were authorized to do.
All right. So there were no differences of opinion between your office and the NSA?
There were no arguments, no pushback, no we want to, no we won't, none of that. No, sir.
Thank you, General. What was the view of NSA lawyers on the argument that was made by the administration that the authorization for use of military force, which was passed by the Congress, authorized this program? Did your people agree with that?
I'd ask you to ask them directly
for their detail.
No, sir. I'll continue. There's more to be said. But when I talked to the NSA lawyers, in most of my personal dialogue with them, they were very comfortable with the Article II arguments and the President's inherent authorities.
Does that mean that they were not comfortable with the argument?
I wouldn't say that, but when they came to me and we discussed its lawfulness, our discussion anchored itself on Article II.
And they made no comment about the authority, which was argued by some coming from the authorization of military?
Not strongly one way or the other. It was Article II.
During the confirmation hearings of Porter Goss, I asked him whether or not he would correct the public statement of a policymaker if that public statement went beyond the intelligence. And here's what Mr. Goss said. If I were confronted with that kind of a hypothetical, where I felt that a policymaker was getting beyond what the intelligence said, I think I would advise the person involved. I do believe that would be a case that would put me into action if I were confirmed. Yes, sir. Do you agree with Porter Goss?
Yes, sir. I think that's a pretty good statement.
Now, an independent review for the CIA conducted by a panel led by Richard Kerr, former deputy director of the CIA, said the following. This relates to the intelligence prior to the Iraq War. Requests for reporting and analysis of Iraq's links to al-Qaeda were steady and heavy in the period leading up to the war, creating significant pressure on the intelligence community to find evidence that supported a connection. Did you agree with Mr. Kerr?
Sir, as director, we did have NSA, as director of NSA, we did have a series of inquiries about this potential connection between al-Qaeda and the Iraqi government. Yes, sir.
Now, prior to the war, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Mr. Feith, established an intelligence analysis cell within his policy office at the Defense Department. While the intelligence community was consistently dubious about links between Iraq and al-Qaeda, Mr. Feith produced an alternative analysis asserting that there was a strong connection. Were you comfortable with Mr. Feith's office approach to intelligence analysis?
No, sir, I wasn't. I wasn't aware of a lot of the activity going on, you know, when it was contemporaneous with running up to the war. No, sir, I wasn't comfortable.
In our meeting in our office, you indicated, what were you uncomfortable about? Let me appreciate it.
There are a couple of things, and thank you for the opportunity to elaborate, because these aren't simple issues. As I try to stay in my statement, there are a lot of things that animate and inform a policymaker's judgment, and intelligence is one of them. And you know, worldview, and there are a whole bunch of other things that are very legitimate. The role of intelligence, I try to say it here by metaphor because it's the best way I can describe it, though, is you got to draw the left and the right-hand boundaries. It's the tether to your analysis can't be so long, so stretched that it gets out of those left and right-hand boundaries. Now, with regard to this particular case, it is possible, Senator, if you want to drill down on an issue and just get laser beam focus and exhaust every possible ounce of evidence, you can build up a pretty strong body of data, right? But you have to know what you're doing, all right? I got three great kids, but if you tell me, go out and find all the bad things they've done, Hayden, I could build you a pretty good dossier, and you'd think they were pretty bad people because that's what I was looking for, and that's what I built up. That'd be very wrong, okay? That'd be inaccurate. That would be misleading. It's one thing to drill down, and it's legitimate to drill down, and that was a real big and real important question. But at the end of the day, when you draw your analysis, you have to recognize that you've really laser beam focused on one particular data set. And you have to put that factor into the equation before you start drawing macro judgments.
You and my office discussed, I think, a very interesting approach, which is the difference between starting with a conclusion and trying to prove it, and instead starting with digging into all the facts and seeing where they take you. Would you just describe for us that difference and why you feel, I think, that related to the difference between what intelligence should be and what some people were doing, including that FIFA office?
Yes, sir, and I actually think I prefaced that with both of these are legitimate forms of reasoning that you've got deducted and the product of, 18 years of Catholic education. I know a lot about deductive reasoning here. There's an approach to the world in which you begin with first principles, and then you work your way down the specifics. And then there's an inductive approach to the world in which you start out there with all the data and work yourself up to general principles. They are both legitimate. But the only one I'm allowed to do is induction.
Allowed to do as an intelligence?
As an intelligence officer is induction. And so, now, what happens when induction meets deduction, Senator? Well, that's my left and right-hand boundaries metaphor.
Now, I believe that you actually placed a disclaimer on NSA reporting relative to any links between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And it was apparently following the repeated inquiries from the FIFA office. Would you just tell us what that disclaimer was?
Yes, sir. SIGINT neither confirms nor denies. And let me stop at that point in the sentence so we can say safely on the side of unclassified. SIGINT neither confirms nor deny. And then we finished the sentence based upon the question that was asked. And then we provided the data, sir.
Now, I think that you've commented on this before, and I may have missed it. And if so, you can just rely on your previous comment. But there's been press reports that you had some disagreements with Secretary Rumsfeld and Undersecretary Cambone with respect to the reform legislation that we were looking at relating to DNI and other intelligence-related matters. Can you tell us whether or not that is accurate? There were disagreements between you and the defense secretary, because some people say you're just going to be the instrument of the defense secretary. And if those reports are right, this would be an example where you disagreed with the defense secretary, who, after all, you wear a uniform, and he is the secretary of defense. Are those reports accurate?
So let me recharacterize them. The secretary and I did discuss this. I think it's what diplomats would call that frank and wide-ranging exchange of views. He treated me with respect. A couple of footnotes just to put some texture to this. I then testified in closed session to the HPSC on different aspects of the pending legislation. It was unclassified testimony, even though the session was closed. DOD put my testimony on their website. NSA didn't. And so, you know, that to me was a pretty telling step, that, you know, this was an open exchange of views. It's been a little bit mischaracterized, too. I did not say move those big three-letter muscular agencies outside of DOD. My solution was something like the Founding Fathers, you know, enumerated powers. You know, don't get bollocked around writing a theory of federalism. Just write down what you want the federal government to do. My view was you needed to write down what authorities the DNI had over NSA, NGA, and NRO. The fact that they stayed inside the Department of Defense was actually pretty uninteresting. As long as you had these enumerated powers that Ambassador Negroponte now has, money, tasking, policy, personnel, classification.
Is it fair to say that on some of those issues there were differences between you and Secretary Rumsfeld?
Yes, sir.
General, there's been a great deal of debate over the treatment of detainees. Do we have one set of rules now that governs the interrogation of detainees, regardless of who is doing the interrogating and regardless of where the interrogations take place?
Yes, Senator, I'll go into more detail on this afternoon, but I do have some things I'd like to say in open session. Obviously, we're going to follow the law. We're going to respect all of America's international responsibilities. In the Detainee Treatment Act, the language is quite clear. It talks about all prisoners of war under the control of the Department of Defense being handled in a way consistent with the Army Field Manual, and then a separate section of the law that requires all agencies of the U.S. government to handle detainees wherever they may be located in a way that is not cruel, inhumane, or degrading. And that's the formula that we will follow.
And the CIA is bound by that formula?
All agencies of the U.S. government are bound by that formula, yes, sir.
And by definition?
By definition,
the CIA
any
is
agency.
Included in that.
Yes, sir.
And so that means, or let me ask you rather than putting words in your mouth, does that mean that the CIA and its personnel and contractors are required to comply at all times in all locations in the same manner as military personnel with the following laws or treaties? A, the Geneva Conventions.
Senator, again, let me refer you to the language in the Detainee Treatment Act, which actually does make a distinction between prisoners of war under the effective control of the Department of Defense and a second, broader description that applies throughout the rest of the government about cruel, inhuman, and degrading.
Are you unable, then, to answer that question?
No, sir, I'm not.
Then what about the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment?
Yes, sir. All agencies of the U.S. government will respect our international obligations.
Including that one?
Yes, sir.
The Detainee Treatment Act of 2005 you've just described?
Right. Yes, sir. Absolutely consistent with that. Sir, can I put a footnote on the previous one?
Sure.
You know, obviously with the reservations that have been stipulated by the U.S. government in the ratification of that treaty.
Finally, the Army Field Manual on Intelligence and Interrogation.
The Army Field Manual, as the Detainee Treatment Act clearly points out, specifically applies to prisoners under the effective control of the Department of Defense.
And therefore, the CIA, you do not believe, is bound by that language?
Again, the legislation does not explicitly or implicitly, I believe, bind anyone beyond the Department of Defense, Senator.
I think my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator DeWine.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. General, welcome.
Thank you, sir.
Good to be with you today.
This is 93.9 at AM 820 WNYC. We are listening. Actually, this is 93.9 WNYC, as we've been listening to a live stretch of the confirmation hearing of General Michael Hayden to run the CIA If you want to continue listening to Gavel to Gavel coverage uninterrupted, you can turn over to AM 820 WNYC. We will go back to the hearings here on 93.9 in a little bit, but we do want to do some analysis of some of the very interesting testimony that we've been hearing so far this morning from General Hayden, I should say, and we're going to do that with Daphna Linzer, who covers intelligence and other issues for The Washington Post. Daphna, thank you very much for coming on with us this morning. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
Let's start with that very last thing that General Hayden was discussing with Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, who was the last questioner, on interrogation standards. By way of background, the president has wanted the CIA to be exempt from some of the anti-torture language in the recent McCain amendment. He wants the military, he says that even if it applies to the military, it should not apply to the CIA. Is that specifically what Senator Levin was asking about?
Indeed he was, and I thought that Hayden's response was very telling, and I think that it's clear that Hayden is trying to project a different image of himself from that of Porter Goss, who was very close to the vice president, who went up on the Hill with the vice president on numerous occasions to fight the anti-torture legislation in order to win exemptions for the CIA, and I thought that Hayden's response has made it clear that he's not looking necessarily for any kind of exemption.
Right. He seemed to say, and I guess we heard it the same way, that everybody who works for the U.S. government is covered by the same standards. Although I understood the president's signing statement on that bill to still reserve the right to apply it differently to different agencies.
That's right, and I think Hayden used that very last moment to jump in and again note the reservations that had come with that legislation.
Interesting. So I guess that goes to the headline for me so far of the morning, which is, rather than on any specific answer, that Hayden obviously has a good mind. He has a good conceptual understanding of what his job is and what he wants it to be, and the pressures of politics on intelligence gathering and how to resist some of those politics. He has that John Roberts, Samuel Alito temperament to withstand tough questioning without losing his cool. I thought it was very interesting there toward the end where he talked about things like laser beaming on your data sets before you make any macro judgments. which is his somewhat wonky way of saying you look very closely at the information you have before you tell the president what it means. And he talked about the difference between inductive and deductive reasoning, something you might not expect to come up in a political Senate hearing, and said all he can do as an intelligence officer is inductive reasoning. And by the way, according to nakedscience.org, deductive reasoning arrives at a specific conclusion based on generalizations. Inductive reasoning takes events and makes generalizations, and it's the latter, going to the general from the specific knowledge, that Hayden says he does as an intelligence officer. Pretty intelligent.
Absolutely, and I think that what came through, I think, for people on the Hill and for people watching inside the intelligence community, excuse me, and within the Bush administration, is Hayden's effort to make himself independent. His effort to demonstrate that he is not going to just give the White House or the president the answers he wants to hear, that he's going to dig deep, as he said, drill down deeply, and come up with a conclusion based on wide-ranging facts and not simply on what the conclusion was hoping for.
Right. So at the risk of engaging in deductive reasoning, if he starts with that as a general concept, did he give any hints other than the interrogation standards as to how he might apply that independence from the White House?
I think that he made a couple interesting observations. Another sort of headline, as you put it, that stuck out for me was when Levin asked him specifically about conversations that occurred in the run-up to the domestic surveillance program that the NSA was operating. The White House has said that one of its legal arguments or the legal basis for the program has been the Congressional War Resolution that was passed in the run-up to the Iraq War, and Levin specifically asked Hayden if that had ever come up in the discussions, and Hayden said no, that in fact he couldn't recall that White House lawyers or White House counsel ever making that argument when they were discussing the program. And I thought out that those kinds of little indications, again, made it clear that Hayden plans to be a different kind of CIA director, either from George Tenet and certainly from Porter Goss.
And going back to the very first questions that Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Pat Roberts asked him over an hour ago, Hayden said that two or three ways come to his mind to improve the intelligence gathering capability of the CIA to avoid a repeat of failures like on Iraq's WMD programs or lack thereof before the war. Robert specifically asked him about those failures. And Hayden's response was that vigorous transparency is what is needed. I think he used those words mm-hmm. on what we know and what we don't know so as not to give policymakers a false sense of certainty. And along with that, he mentioned a higher tolerance for ambiguity and more running room, as he called it, for he said, she said inside the analysis. That is just making underlying agreements a part of the report and not to hide them through the use of abstractions. Again, that's another way of getting at the same thing, isn't it?
It is indeed. And I think it'll be interesting to see how that actually ends up working out. I think that, as you know very well, much of Hayden's strategies are, you know, direct results of the run-up to the Iraq war and the flawed intelligence on Iraq's weapons program. And I think that what he's emphasizing is an attempt to go really in the other direction, as you just noted. And we'll see how that works. I think that, you know, there are going to be risks to that strategy as well. You will be giving, or the CIA will be giving policymakers, as you say, more ambiguous analysis, less concrete judgments. And it's not clear how that will help in the future or possibly hinder decision making. So, you know, he's definitely moving in a direction in which he's emphasizing that he has learned the lessons of the Iraq failings. And now it'll be interesting to see if his solutions make any difference.
By the way, we just got a call from a listener off the air who says we should look up abductive reasoning, which is a combination of inductive and deductive, which means reasoning to the best explanations, and that's what this administration is often missing. At least so says this caller. Somehow I don't expect any member of the Senate Intelligence Committee to ask General Hayden about abductive reasoning. we'll go back to the hearing in a minute, but Senator Levin asked an interesting question that I thought drew an interesting response. Hayden seemed to deny a New York Times story from March that there were disagreements between the NSA and Vice President Cheney's office about how far the telephone monitoring program should go. Did you pick up on that?
Yeah, I did. I wasn't clear exactly what Hayden was saying. I mean, I think that he was eager to take away the impression that had been left by the story that there were disagreements. But then, you know, often in his testimony when he was asked about discussions that he'd had, you know, throughout the government, he said, well, you know, there are differences and we work them out, but it's not hostile. And, you know, everybody has different opinions when you go in and you work it out. So my sense, you know, and he also did say that he did detect, I think he said, a strand of familiarity in that report. So I'm not sure that his testimony completely cleared things up for me on that story, although it's clear that, you know, Hayden is going into a job and has been quite close to the vice president in the last year or so, and I think that he wants to remain on good terms with everybody as well.
And again, for all the abstract generalizations about being independent from the White House on a very key issue, it seemed to me that he took the White House's position, which is, he said his lawyers at the NSA supported the president's contention that the president has the authority under his war-making powers, Article 2 of the Constitution, to wiretap without court warrants because the Constitution trumps the FISA Act. Did you get that?
Yeah, I did. I thought that was interesting as well. And again, I think I would have to go back and listen to exactly the way that Hayden parsed that language, because we have reported as well that there were lots of lawyers throughout the government who were involved in the program who did not believe that it was legal, who believed that it was very problematic. And in fact, the program was halted twice since its inception in 2001. specifically because lawyers had such problems with it. The judge, who was the head judge of the FISA court, lawyers, they're very senior lawyers inside the Justice Department and elsewhere in the administration. So I think I'd have to go back and listen to it, but there's no question that there were lots of legal problems among the very few people who were even aware of the program.
All right. Daphna Linzer, staff writer for The Washington Post. Very good analysis, very abductive. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Brian.
We'll go back to the hearing in just a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
WNYC is supported by the 92nd Street Y, presenting an evening with author Simon Shama discussing his new book, Rough Crossing, about Britain, slavery, and the American Revolution, May 30th at 8. Tickets at 92y.org or 212-415-5500. TheaterMania.com, offering information and tickets for Broadway, off and off-off Broadway, kids and other shows nationwide. More information and an email newsletter with offers are online at TheaterMania.com. Plaza Jewish Community Chapel, owned and operated by the Jewish community, located at 91st Street and Amsterdam, offering a full range of funeral services, including personalized pre-need funerals, online at plazajewishcommunitychapel.org. St. Francis College, offering two summer sessions designed to help students accelerate in a program of study, fulfill prerequisites, or get a taste of college for the first time, starting June 5th, 718-489-3466. Maharishi Enlightenment Centers, for over 50 years teaching the Transcendental Meditation Program for individuals seeking to reduce stress, improve health, and increase happiness. More at 1-800-LEARN-TM or tm.org.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Quick reminder that at noon, you will have a choice. We will bring you the Leonard Lopez Show, as usual, here on 93.9 and all our afternoon programming. Or at that time, you'll be able to continue to listen to the hearings, the General Michael Hayden, CIA Director, confirmation hearings, live gavel to gavel on our AM station, AM 820. We're going to go back into the hearings right now. General Hayden is answering questions from Republican Senator Mike DeWine of Ohio. General Hayden speaking right now.
Fundamentally, these are questions of policy. In the current post with the DNI, we've actually taken some steps forward in this regard, and perhaps this afternoon I can elaborate on that a bit as to some things we have done. But I can tell you in open session, you just have to will it. I mean, you're not going to get everyone saying, oh, yeah, this is good and it's okay. You're not going to get everyone to agree. It, in many ways, you just have to make the decision and move forward. And we've done that on two or three things I'd really be happy to share with you this afternoon. Now, I need to be careful. As I said earlier, you know, human intelligence sources are a bit more fragile, I mean that literally, than other kinds of sources, and that has to be respected. But as we did at NSA, I think that the way ahead is you hold all the premises up to the light. Senator, there was an instance in NSA when we were trying to go forward and do something and someone said, you can't do that. There are several policies against it. And it took me a while of getting those kinds of briefings to then say, whose policies?
Yeah. I mean,
they were mine.
Yeah.
They were under my control. And so they were changeable. They weren't you know, handed down to us from Mount Sinai.
General, I appreciate your answer. Just one final comment,
yes,
before I turn it back to the chairman. This committee has spent a lot of time looking at what happened after September 11th. We've looked at a lot of problems and the challenges of the intelligence community. It seems to me one of the biggest challenges is to make sure that every consumer, every person who needs to know, every analyst who needs to know information gets that information in a timely manner. It's so simple to state, but it's so hard many times to implement. And, you know, your dedication to making sure that that happens and we change the culture, we drive through that culture, the technology is there. We just simply have to do it.
Yes, sir.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wyden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General, good morning to you and your family. And Mrs. Hayden, you'll be interested
this
to know.
This is Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon.
About how much you two love to go to those Steelers games together. so I know y'all are very devoted to family, and we're glad you're here. General, like millions of Americans, I deeply respect the men and women who wear the uniform of the United States. Every day, our military risks life and limb to protect our freedom, demonstrating qualities like accepting personal responsibility that are America at its best. Here on the Senate Intelligence Committee, I've supported our national security at a time of war by voting to give you the tools needed to relentlessly fight the terrorists while maintaining vigilance over the rights of our citizens. Those votes I've cast fund a number of top-secret programs that have to be kept under wraps because America cannot vanquish its enemies by telegraphing our punches. Now, in return for keeping most of the vital work of this committee secret, federal law, the National Security Act of 1947, stipulates, and I quote here, "You keep the Congressional Intelligence Committees fully and currently informed of all intelligence activities other than a covert action." It is with regret that I conclude that you and the Bush administration have not done so. Despite yesterday's last-minute briefing, for years, General, you and the Bush administration have not kept the committee fully and currently informed of all appropriate intelligence activities. Until just yesterday, for example, for some time now, only two Democratic senators present this morning were allowed by the Bush administration to be briefed on all these matters that are all over our newspapers. These failures, in my view, have put the American people in a difficult spot. Because the committee hasn't been kept informed, because of these revelations in the newspapers, now we have many of our citizens, law-abiding, patriotic Americans who want to strike the balance between fighting terrorism and protecting liberty, now they're questioning their government's word. So let me turn to my questions.
Sir.
In your opening statement, you said that under your leadership, the CIA would act according to American values. So we're not talking about a law here, but we're talking about values. For me, values are about following the law and doing what you say you're going to do. When it comes to values, credibility is at the top of my list. Now, General, having evaluated your words, I now have a difficult time with your credibility. And let me be specific. On the wiretapping program, in 2001, you were told by the president's lawyers that you had authority to listen to Americans' phone calls. But a year later, in 2002, you testified that you had no authority to listen to Americans' phone calls in the United States unless you had enough evidence for a warrant. But you have since admitted you were wiretapping Americans. Let me give you another example. After you admitted you were wiretapping Americans, you said on six separate occasions the program was limited to domestic to international calls. Now the press is reporting that the NSA has amassed this huge database that we've been discussing today of domestic calls. So, with all due respect, General, I can't tell now if you've simply said one thing and done another, or whether you have just parsed your words like a lawyer to intentionally mislead the public. What's to say that if you're confirmed to head the CIA, we won't go through exactly this kind of drill with you over there?
Well, Senator, you're going to have to make a judgment on my character. And let me talk a little bit about the incidents that you brought up. The first one, I believe, is testimony in front of the combined HPSI and CISI, the Joint Inquiry Commission on the attacks in 9/11. And in my prepared remarks, I was trying to be very careful because we were talking not in closed session in front of the whole committee, but in front of the whole committee in totally open session. I believe, and I haven't looked at those remarks for a couple of months now, I believe I began them by saying that I had been forthcoming in closed sessions with the committee. Now, you may quibble that I've been forthcoming in closed sessions with some of my information with the leadership of the committee or with the entire committee, but the language of the statute you referred to earlier does allow for limited briefings in certain circumstances, and I know there will probably be questions on what are those legitimate circumstances. If anyone in the U.S. government should be empathetic to the dilemma of someone in the position I was in, it should be members of this committee who have classified knowledge of flitting around their left and right lobes every time they go out to make a public statement. You cannot avoid in your responsibilities talking about Iran or talking about Iraq or talking about terrorist surveillance. But you have classified knowledge. And your challenge and your responsibility is to give your audience at that moment the fullest, most complete, most honest rendition you can give them, knowing that you are prevented by law from telling them everything you know. That's what I did when I was speaking in front of the National Press Club. I chose my words very carefully because I knew that someday I would be having this conversation. I chose my words very carefully because I wanted to be honest with the people I was addressing, and it wasn't that handful of folks downtown. It was looking into the cameras and talking to the American people. I bounded my remarks by the program that the president had described in his December radio address. It was the program that was being publicly discussed. And at key points in my remarks, I pointedly and consciously downshifted the language I was using. So when I was talking about a drift net over Lackawanna or Fremont or other cities, I switched from the word communications to the much more specific and unarguably accurate conversations. And then I went on in the speech and later in my question and answer period to say, we do not use the content of communications to decide which communications we want to study the content of. In other words, when we looked at the content of a communication, everything between hello and goodbye, we had already established a probable cause standard, that we had reason to believe that that communication, one or both of those communicants, were associated with Al-Qaeda. Senator, I was as full and open as I possibly could be. In addition, my natural instincts, which I think all of you have seen, is to be as full and open as law and policy allow when I'm talking to you as well. Anyone who's gotten a briefing on the terrorist surveillance program from me, and up until yesterday, that was everybody who had ever gotten a briefing on the terrorist surveillance program, I would be shocked if they thought I was hiding anything. There was only one purpose in my briefing, and that was to make sure that everyone who was getting that briefing fully understood what NSA was doing. Now, Senator, I know you and other members of the committee have concerns that we've gone from 2 to 5 to 7 to the full committee. I understand that. I told you in my open remarks what my instincts were in terms of briefing the full committee. There's a very, very crude airman's metaphor that talks about if you want people at the crash, you got to put them on the manifest.
Right? General,
so
let
I understand. Senator, if I can make just one more remark, okay? And so my personal commitment is to be as open as possible. I cannot commit, Senator, to resolving the inherent stresses between Article 1 and Article 2 of the Constitution that were intentionally put in there by the Founding Fathers.
General, I'm focused just on the public record, and I'm going to go out and try now to dissect what you have just said and compare it to those other statements.
Yes, sir.
But let me give you a very quick example.
Okay.
The Trailblazer program. As you know, I'm committed to being careful about discussing this in public, sensitive information technology program. But as you know, I asked you about this in open session.
Yes, sir.
When you were up to be deputy of DNI. I went back and looked at the record, and you said, Senator Wyden, we are overachieving on that program. Those were your words. I opened up the Newsweek magazine this week, and there are quoted, again, just out of a news report, reports that there's $1 billion worth of software laying around. People who have decades of experience saying, I think their quote was a complete and abject failure. And so I ask you again, I'm concerned about a pattern where you say one thing in these open kind of hearings, and then I and others have got to get a good clipping service to try to figure out what independent people are saying and then to reconcile them. So, were you accurate when you came in an open session to say that the Trailblazer program was overachieving?
Senator, the open session you're referring to, is that last year during the confirmation?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Senator, I will promise you I will go back and read my words. But what my memory tells me I said was that a lot of the failure in the Trailblazer program was in the fact we were trying to overachieve. We were throwing deep, and we should have been throwing short passes, if you want to use a metaphor. And that a lot of the failure was we were trying to do too much all at once. We should have been less grandiose, not gone for moonshots, and been tighter in, more specific, looking at concrete results closer in rather than overachieving by reaching too far. My memory is that's what I was describing. I can't ever think of my saying we were overachieving in Trailblazer. That was a tough program, Senator.
Those were your words, General. And again, I question, using your words, open session, whether we have got on that particular program the level of forthcoming statements that is warranted. And to me, this is a pattern and something that has made me ask these questions about credibility. Now, to move on to the next area, for 200 years, our government has operated on the proposition that the people must have some sort of independent check on the government. Americans want to trust their leaders, but they also want checks and balances.
You've been listening this morning to live coverage of CIA Director nominee Michael Hayden's confirmation hearings before the Senate Intelligence Committee, and now you have a choice. You can stay with the hearings by turning over to our AM station, AM 820 WNYC, if you want to continue to listen to Senator Wyden's tough questioning here of General Hayden, or stay here on 93.9 for our regular afternoon programming, beginning 1 minute from now with the Leonard Lopate Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.